nous allons passer à la présentation suivante, donc qui va être, je crois, en anglais. Elle va nous être fournie par Albert Adewoba et Deborah Atobra, donc sur les questions de notion d'enfant et de taille de famille idéale, je crois.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairperson, ladies and gentlemen. My name is A.K. Awedoba, Albert Kanlisi Awedoba, and I'm presenting this paper on behalf of myself and Deborah Atobra, who is my colleague. The title, as you can well see, is Ghanaian Children's Notions of the Ideal Family. So essentially, we're going to be talking about children's notions. The paper, as you may well know from previous speakers, is essentially an ethnographic study of urban, peri-urban, and rural communities in the greater Accra region of Ghana. So our focus essentially is on children in grades 5 and 6. And these are people's age between 10 and 13 years of age. I should mention that these children are essentially Ghana children, because the area we're talking about is Ghana area, although the Ghana people are not necessarily the predominant ethnic group of Accra. They are a minority, so to speak, within Accra itself. So what we're trying to do is to get children's perspectives on reproductive issues. So we did two things. We decided that children in class 5 should draw a picture of what they consider as the ideal family. And after they had drawn the pictures, we were present when they drew the pictures. It took about 30 minutes, sometimes slightly more than that, for children to compose their pictures. After that, we collected the pictures, and then we interrogated a number of them, not all of them. We asked them to tell us exactly what it is that they were trying to draw. And we made notes about their comments. In the case of class 6, we asked them to write an essay on what they consider as their ideal family for the future. That is, if you grew up to become an adult, what kind of family did you think you were going to have? So that is essentially what we try to do as far as this part of the study is concerned. So it is an aspect of the broader ethnographic study that we did in the Ghana communities. So this is just a subset of it. Now, children's voices are very important, and I think personally that policymakers ought to listen a little bit more to children. Prowse, 2000, and others have indeed remarked that children are not only shaped by society, but also shape it in their own ways. It is clear that it is children who grow and become adults one day. Therefore, if children have got perspectives, it is very essential that we should take on board those perspectives in our policies. We also realize that in the African context, the grooming of a child, the socialization of a child, is through the processes of participant observation. In other words, children are critical observers of what is happening in the community. What are the things that their parents do, others do, and so on and so forth. These things don't escape them. So for me, it is very important, at least from the methodological perspective, to look at what children are saying, because they provide us with a kind of window into society's perspectives, attitudes, and so on and so forth. In any case, it enables us to interrogate what the adults are telling us. Now, children certainly know much as far as reproductive health issues are concerned. And it is not just the researchers who are of this view. Even the communities, the people that we have researched, also believe the same. So this is a comment that one of our respondents made. And we're not asking the person to talk about children. We're talking about other things, and this comment was made. And this is what she says, a mother of 28 years old. She says, sometimes when I eavesdrop on children's conversations, and in particular my own children of about 8 and 6, I get amazed at the kinds of issues they raise. They talk about sex, having children, and love. And sometimes I wonder how they are so knowledgeable. So this rich information which is lying there needs to be tapped. And this is what we thought we should do. So this is just an example, just to let you understand what we're doing, the kind of situation in which we did this kind of research. So this is a portion of a classroom writing, kids writing the essays. Maybe the pictures on the walls are not very clear to you, but I think the pictures themselves also tell us a lot about what is going on. That is also very important information. You see children, human parts, human bodies, and so on and so forth. This tells us something about what goes on in the classroom. Now, this is one picture, a picture drawn by somebody called, for our purposes, called Emmanuel. Now, Emmanuel tells us from this picture, Emmanuel is the big man with a hat. Now, he tells us that he would opt for 4 children, a boy, a girl, a boy, and a girl. That is in that kind of order. And he says that his firstborn will go to school. The second boy, who is a girl, will sweep. The third boy will study. And the fourth one will nurse her mother in ill health. Why she thinks that the last one should nurse the mother, I don't know. Probably back at home, the mother is not well or something is ill. I don't know. Maybe. Now, the second one is a girl also. It's a girl. Her name is Rebecca. And Rebecca opts for 1 child. And the reason is that school fees are very high. Now, that is also true. If you look at the Accra context, all the government says that there is free schooling, there's free this, it is giving access, it's giving uniforms free, it's giving meals free. The truth of the matter is that if you want to access quality education from the Accra perspective, you have to have money. You have to send your kid to a private school where there's better tuition, better facilities, and so on and so forth. So I guess this is the point that the little girl is trying to tell us. But she herself hopes someday to become a nurse. And you can see from the picture, that's a nurse. And not only a nurse, but a nurse who also does trading on the side. Which is, not so surprising, because women work, they have got their official jobs, but they also do trading. So this is the kind of picture the girl is trying to present. So she wants just 1 child, but it's very important that she wants a daughter. She doesn't want a boy. She says that boys are not an asset as far as she's concerned. Now, there is the third person, also a girl here. She is Salmata, and Salmata does not wish to have children, which is very unusual, but she says she doesn't want to have children. Why? She fears that she might not have the means to feed them, which is also very important because it looks like economic resources, economic constraints are beginning to play a very important, significant role as far as the desire for children is concerned in the Ghanaian context. Now, the fourth one is, again, a picture drawn by a girl. I'm sorry for selecting 3 pictures drawn by girls as opposed to 1 by a boy. Some of these pictures are illustrative in a certain kind of sense. If you take Elizabeth, Elizabeth is saying that it's giving us a picture in which there is herself, there is her husband, there are 2 children, and there's a co-wife. In other words, this girl expects that in future she's going to be married to a man who has another wife. I don't know why, but this is the reality. Now, if you look at the comments, the essays that people write, a certain kind of perception of life begins to show up. You may call it a refraction or social disequilibrium in the case of Accra, where there are all these inequalities. There's poverty, there's wealth, and the two are running more or less side by side. So if you take Papasi, which is a poor rural community, the children there want to become professionals. They want to enjoy secure professions, employment. They want to be footballers. Right now, Ghanaian footballers are not doing badly at all. So they want to be footballers. They want to be nurses. They want to be traders, doctors, soldiers, teachers, and so on and so forth. They all want to have spouses who are well-to-do. Nobody wants to be married to a poor person. What is important is that they want spouses that are responsible people. And I need to emphasize this because I have actually got a case where the kid was so upset about his own father, how the father has been, irresponsible, and so on and so forth. So it looks like responsibility, especially partner responsibility, becomes an issue as far as the Ghanaian context is concerned. Now, these kids all want to have a kind of upper class or middle class lifestyle. To live in big city, to live in the city of Accra, to have beautiful houses, expensive cars, four-wheel drive cars, and so on and so forth. They want all of that. But importantly, they want their children to be well-fed and to have quality education. They also want to live Christian lives in the fear of God and devoid of crime and social vices. And they mention prostitution. Yeah. So we looked at a number of, studying the essays that present themselves against certain kinds of themes. The issue of marriage obviously comes up first. And the children are saying that they want to be married, but they want to begin married life between the ages of 25 and 35. And the reason is that by then they would have finished tertiary education and begin fully employed. Okay? They also want to have monogamous marriages. They don't want to have more than one. Okay? And when we ask why they would rather have more than, just limit themselves to one wife, in the case of the boys, they had a number of reasons. Some said that polygyny was stressful and traumatizing. The co-wives are always bickering and quarreling among themselves. Not good enough. Some raised economic constraints. They said, these days, you don't have the means to cater for people, for family. So if you've got another wife, it means more resources. Where are you going to get that from? Some are also invoking emotional reasons. And there is this kid who is saying that he'd rather stay by one wife because having more than one wife is a sign of infidelity. Now, these are kids who are monogamous in their orientations. Now we ask ourselves, whether are they the only people who are voices? And we came across a few who are saying that they would want to have more than one wife. What is interesting is that they all cite King Solomon as the example. King Solomon, in one case, this 12-year-old is saying that he wants two wives. And his reason is that I also want to marry two wives because I want to follow the steps of King Solomon. King Solomon married 300 wives and 700 girlfriends. But me, I'll marry two to be able to control them as a good husband. So he has to be able to control his wives. If you have more than that, you can't control them. So you take two. That will do. But you see, so these are boys talking. So what about the girls? I already gave you the case of a girl who is preempting that in future her husband will have another wife in addition to herself. But there were girls who said that they were expecting their parents to find suitable, responsible husbands for them. So, naturally, if you're going to be dependent on your parents to find you a wife, a husband, you shouldn't be surprised if the most responsible person also happens to be one who has more than one wife. But they didn't say they wanted to have those kinds of husbands. Now, what about parenthood itself? Is there any demand for it? It turns out that these kids really want to be parents. All of them, nearly all of them, want to be parents. And there are reasons for that. The main reason seems to be that they want to be successors. They want to have a successor. Someone to take after you, okay? It seems to be important to people that when they die, there's someone who remains. I don't know why kids would think that way, but this is what they thought. Some said they wanted a helper and a companion. And the women especially wanted a companion. They wanted a girl child to be a companion. Some cited social prestige. And of course, in these communities, if you are childless, you are considered as a total failure. They didn't want that. But interesting enough, and to my surprise, is the case of this kid who is talking about social security. And it's not just one kid. Several of them are talking about security in old age. And this is the comment that the person made. I would like them, that is in brackets, my children, to grow and travel to different countries. Ghanaian kids, Ghanaian youth these days travel a lot to Europe, America, and so on and so forth. So he wants his kids there to travel to different countries, to explore their ambitions so that when I grow old, they can support me when I'm in need of something. Yeah, so this is what she wants, you see, to have children who will take care of you in future. Now, so how many children do these kids want? Well, the number ranges from zero, a person who says, no, I'm not interested in a kid at all, to a maximum of 20. So the main consideration, of course, is economic. And they always said that those who wanted fewer kids said, well, my means in future may not be adequate to cater for so many, so I just want a limited number. But there were some who opted for 20. Now, one kid in particular wanted six, and the reason for having six, for wanting six, is the fact that his own father had 10. So his parents would put pressure on him to have six, because your father had six, had 10, so the least that you can do is to have six. And of course, the gentleman who wanted to have 10 wives also said he wanted 20 children. So each wife would have two kids. Yeah. But what we discovered was that he wanted 17 sons and only 3 daughters. But let me just say that as far as the majority of our sample are concerned, they wanted to have around 4 or so kids per family. So that then is the ideal number, you see. And it is very interesting that they are asking for 4, because the adults, their parents, the people we interviewed outside, also wanted a 4. The vast majority of them were asking for a number around 4 or so. Now, we asked a respondent who opted for 4. But why 4? Why do you people want 4? And his response was that, I would like my children to have 4. That is, when we asked him, how many children would you advise your children to have? How many children would you advise your kids in future to have? He said that he wants his children to have 4 each. And the reason is that the number 4 is a special number. It is an even number. You see, he doesn't want odd numbers, you see. Now, even numbers are very important. They are auspicious numbers in Ghanaian societies. Maybe that is it. But you have to put all this, against the traditional ideal. For a Ghana person, the traditional ideal was, as a mother, was to have 10. And if you're able to have 10 children, they conduct a very important festival for you. I mean, big ceremony, festival, I mean, give you a sheep. And the name of that is called the Nyongutu. So they gave that to you as a sign of a greater achievement. Yeah, but of course, these days, there's a kind of change. You see, nobody now wants that. They found it ridiculous. They were asking for 10. How are you going to maintain all these care? How are you going to educate them? And so on and so forth. What about the choice of sex? We discovered that girl people prefer daughters. Boys, on the other hand, opted for sons. Of course, these are kids. They may change their minds later on in life, but we don't know. But at that point in time, maybe because of classroom interactions, you see, the boys always feeling that the girls were a nuisance, the girls feeling that the boys were too much of a handful. There was that kind of perception between boys and girls. Girls wanted to have daughters, boys wanted to have sons, and so on and so forth. And of course, there is also the fact that they are mindful of, but the vast majority of them wanted to have a mixture, both boys and girls within the family. And this is because of a certain awareness that, you see, there are certain kinds of duties, tasks, and so on and so forth, responsibility, which you can entrust to girls, as opposed to boys, and vice versa. And this is what this child was saying when he said he wanted a firstborn child who is a boy to go to school, the second who is a girl to do house chores, the third to study to higher education, and the fourth to be a nurse and take care of the mother if the mother were to fall sick. Yeah, so this is the kind of perception that we found as far as the kids are concerned. So, having said all this, I think we need to ask one other question, you see. Where do the kids get all these ideas from, okay? Maybe, from my perspective, policymakers may well want to find out how children come by the kinds of ideas that they have, okay? And we have decided to, more or less, we're looking at the kids, so we're making the study not only synchronic, but also diachronic, sense that, look, let's ask the adults, because they were once upon a time children. In fact, we didn't even ask them. They volunteered the information when we asked certain kinds of questions which required them to make certain kinds of responses. So from the snippets of comments made by adults, we get an idea where children get their information. So one source of this kind of information is sexual abuse. Okay, children get to know about sex because they are being exposed to it by adults. That is how they get it. So there is this statement that we have there. I had sexual intercourse when I was about 6 years old, and my mother's friend had sex with me when my mother was outside the country. She would start doing things to me, kissing and fumbling me, and would remove my clothes and put me on her and rock me, moving up and down as couples engage in sexual intercourse. So these kinds of interactions, it's adults who expose these things. When you ask people, how did you first learn about sex? The reason they learned about sex through these kinds of interactions. Now, children learn about sex from careless adults. Okay, the carelessness of adults is responsible for some of the kinds of information that children get. For example, if you find, for example, that in some of the communities, I mean, the household is crowded up. You see, a single bedroom is shared by so many people, the parents, the adults, the children, and so on and so forth. So sometimes children actually see the kinds of things that the adults do in the night. When they think that the children are asleep, they're not asleep, they're watching. So, but this is one example of carelessness resulting in a kid, eavesdropping on sexual activity. The gentleman says, I was going to buy something, but I did not come early. So I made the door widely open, and I saw them having sex. They did not see me, so I went back to rather spy on them, and I got to know how to have sex. So, because they were careless, this person who didn't know anything about sex now got it. Now, exposure to movies, pornographic material, and so on, these are also factors. Now, this is a comment that somebody volunteered. I was about 12 years or so. There was this pornographic book that a friend brought to school, and we used to watch it. It was something we knew. People were doing it. The white people were doing it. And we thought, if we watched it, we'd become good at sex. We'd become good at sex performance. This was a 32-year-old man commenting on how he first got information about sex. So, sometimes also children get these ideas from other ways. For example, play acting. See, peer group education. You see, they educate themselves. They also, when they are out, sitting by themselves, even as toddlers, they begin to play mamas and dadas, and they begin to observe things, do things, and so on and so forth. That is also part of it. For example, there's this 62-year-old urban guy, male, who recollects a childhood experience. He says, I was about 10 years old. We took our baths with the girls. We would play mother and father. I knew by then that on seeing a girl, my penis would erect. We did not have education on the subject. We did not talk to adults about it, as such behavior was attributed to bad boys. In fact, among young people, you don't talk sex. Children should not be talking sex. Adults should not be talking sex to them. You should educate them about sex. So sources of information still continue with that. So adult conjugal roles are sometimes conferred on children. And this is normal in many Ghanaian communities. So, for example, it's normal to refer to a little girl as my wife, just as it is normal to refer to, for a woman to refer to a little boy as my husband. So they begin to understand the differences between the sexes and so on and so forth. But let's not also forget that there is an attempt to teach sex education in the classrooms. So, for example, in some of the classrooms have biology lessons where there's an attempt to address the subject. So, for example, this 32-year-old man makes the comment. They started teaching us about these things when we were in class 5. They told us that before you become a real woman or an adult, you will experience these things and you will have certain feelings. And if you are a man, you will see certain things. And if you do not take care and you have an affair with a man, you will become pregnant. So at least the classrooms make an effort. But you may well ask, is this enough? Menarche, that is also when traditionally parents would educate their children about sex. So the guys always did that, traditionally. In fact, almost all the cases that were examined, they told us that The first time they experienced menarche, they didn't know what it was. They were told, the parents noticed this, and then they told them, look, from this point onwards, you're now a woman. Okay, you have to be very careful how you relate with men. Otherwise, you get pregnant. You don't touch men. But is this also adequate information? Don't touch men. Okay, don't let men touch you. What does that mean? Is it physical touch? What kind of touch are we talking about? But there are those who also learn about sex through wet dream experience. You see, a young man, may not know anything about sexual pleasures and things like that. But through sex, through wet dreaming, the person may eventually experience what it is. This is exactly what this 31-year-old said. I've experienced wet dreaming. This was the first time that I realized I was capable of impregnating a woman since I produced sperms. It happened at the age of 13 or 14. It couldn't be certain. So, maybe a few tentative conclusions. We have to understand that pornographic materials circulate in the schools. This is clear. Okay? Children do send pornographic materials to a classroom. So, if this is so, maybe the education authorities ought to set up and see what can be done about this. Now, if it is true that children hanker for information on reproductive health, they want it, okay? They desire it. Maybe we should find a way of providing this to 10-year-olds and 12-year-olds. Now, primary school children tend to practice what they learn. Sometimes their teachers are also involved. So a certain amount of sexual misbehavior obtains even the primary school. And there have been media accounts. I haven't got that here, but I could have produced that. I've got that on my computer, you see, of cases where one little kid has succeeded in impregnating six of his classmates, okay? P6 kid. So these kinds of things do happen. When people learn these things, they try to experiment. Maybe we need to do something about that. And finally, there is a point about pedophilia, which involves abuse of infants. And as the previous presenter made it clear, it begins to look as if we ignore that. You see, we don't consider that as of importance, okay? That a boy can be abused by a woman. And yet, as far as I'm concerned, this is also something that we should take seriously, we should think seriously about. Whether we should stop it, whether it doesn't have repercussions on these kinds of children who are prematurely exposed to direct sexual activity. So thanks very much, ladies and gentlemen.